Hello, I'm Rosie Goldsmith, and a very happy new year from all of us at Slightly Foxed here in Hoxton Square, London, and welcome to our first Slightly Foxed podcast of 2026. There are lots of excited hearts racing in the office today. Up to now, a racing heart is the closest to racing that I've ever got. I confess that I'm not a horse racing fan, and my BBC presenting jobs never involved racing commentaries. But perhaps today's guests will help change my mind. You'll all remember jockey and writer Dick Francis, quite simply horse racing royalty. He died in 2010, but left a legacy of remarkable racing achievements and over 40 books, thrillers with horses and racing at their heart, and they're all still in print. He was a phenomenon. We're delighted to welcome none other than Dick Francis's son, Felix Francis, himself a successful crime writer and champion of the Francis franchise, and Derek Thompson Tomo, one of this country's most loved horse racing commentators for over the decades, the BBC, ITV, Channel 4 and Sky, and he's a long-term friend of the Francis family. Welcome to you both. It's great to have you here. Really looking forward to this and to some tips on how to write thrillers and also how to do good racing commentators.
Well, yeah. Also tips for some winners as well.
Yes, yes. Honestly. Yes. We need this boost at the beginning of the year, I can tell you. A little bit of more money in the coffers would also help. So we're going to be discussing the life and work of the great late Dick Francis, and hopefully we'll get all these tips as well from Felix and Derek. Joining us around the table, as usual, are Slightly Fox publishers and editors Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Happy New Year.
And to you.
Now, Gail, I think you're the Dick Francis super fan, aren't you? Have you read them all?
I don't think I've read them all, but I've read an awful lot of them and reread a lot of them.
Gosh.
As well.
Gosh.
And they're my go-to comfort reading when I've got flu or just feeling a bit tired or just want some escapism. And I just love them.
Gosh, so your heart will definitely be racing a little bit faster through this one. We'll be relying on you, I think. And what about you, Hazel? Are you racing or a...
No, I'm not really, but I've learned a lot.
You've read a few.
I've read a few, but I think it's a bit of my brain missing. I can never work out quite how the end is reached. But anyway, sorry about that.
Poor Felix anyway. And Derek, they've got a lot to contend with. Sorry about this.
The horse who wins is the one who crosses the line first. Yeah. Always remember that.
No, I mean, in the books, I can't work it out.
Felix.
My problem is that I know who's going to win the race before it starts when it's in the book.
Yes.
Oh. And it's always a bit of a shock when I go to the races and I realise that I don't know who's going to win.
Exactly. Yes.
That's for thrillers as well. You should always know who's committed the crime, I suppose. Derek and Felix, do forgive me if I first catch up with Gail and Hazel to find out what the Slightly Fox team have been up to since we last met 3 months ago and what you have in store for 2026. Gail.
Yeah, well, the office is recovering from Christmas, which was a bit of a whirlwind, as it always is. But we've cleared the decks and we are looking forward to reissuing a lovely childhood memoir in March by Robert Westall, who wrote The Machine Gunners, which won the Carnegie Medal, and he wrote a lot of other children's books. He was born in Tyneside and grew up there during the war, which is where The Machine Gunners is set. And he was obviously a very clever boy and ended up going to grammar school. But his account, it's called The Making of Me, is just a marvellous evocation of boyhood during that time, growing up and learning to write. And the memoir is just, it's charming and it's funny and it's thoughtful. So that's the book.
That sounds really,
really
good.
Really good writer. Mm.
Yeah. So what have you got, Hazel?
Well,
to tell us.
I think Gail's going to tell us about the spring issue, aren't you?
Yes, so okay, the spring issue has gone off to the printers and there's a lovely piece on Cecil Beaton's diaries. We've got a piece on a novel by Penelope Fitzgerald called Offshore. Bruce Chatwin on The Black Hill, which we haven't had anything on Bruce Chatwin so far, so I'm pleased about that. A lovely book about the River Wye by Robert Gibbings, who founded the Golden Cockerel Press and was a wood engraver. And
will you have any of the wood engravings on the cover?
We will have wood engravings in the article, yes. And then a beautiful children's book by Andre Morois called Fatty Puffs and Thinifers, which is just charming and very entertaining. It's a delight. So, yeah, lots of good things in the issue.
Absolutely.
And
wonderful.
A very beautiful cover of a wood on Dartmoor called Wisman's Wood, which is one of the last bits of ancient forest, temperate rainforest in Britain. And the painting is by Andrew Gifford. So, yeah, full of good things.
What I'd just like to mention,
Hazel,
also,
do go ahead.
That,
yeah.
We were talking recently about the fact that some of our best pieces have come from our writers' competitions, and we thought it was about time for another one. So in the spring issue, we're advertising it. The details will be on the website. You don't have to get the piece in until the 1st of September, so there's the whole of the summer to let the creative juices flow. So we're looking forward to getting some nice 1,500-word pieces and the surprise, and the pieces will appear in Slightly Foxed. So
you never know, one day maybe on a Slightly Foxed podcast.
Yes, precisely.
That's really, really lovely to hear. I mean, and each time you talk about, you know, the months ahead, there's something new for me to discover as well. And I love this combination of the covers and the artwork and the writing. And I know how important it is to you. It really makes Slightly Foxed stand out, I think.
It's the best part of my job is finding the covers and finding the illustrations.
And they're always beautiful.
Or commissioning them.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Gail and Hazel. Now, welcome back to Felix Francis and Derek Thompson, and back to the story of Dick Francis, and what a story it is. A young lad who left school at 15 with no qualifications, who became a champion jockey, the Queen Mother's personal jockey, no less, and friends with the late Queen and Queen Mother. When he gave up professional racing, Dick Francis then enjoyed a second career as a best-selling novelist, writing over 40 books in as many years and selling over 60 million copies worldwide. He was also a racing correspondent for the Sunday Express and during the war had served as an RAF pilot. Dick Francis was 89 when he died in 2010, and I remember the national outpouring of grief and admiration. It was the death of a legend. Felix, what was it about your dad, about Dick Francis, that made him such a popular national figure?
Well, he had two things that were important in his life, and they were courage and loyalty. In fact, it's part of the family motto. He certainly had buckets of both. I mean, he was a jump jockey, and jump jockeys are a breed apart because every time they go out to race, they put their lives on the line. But prior to becoming a jockey, and he didn't become a jockey until he was 26, which is really late because the war got in the way. And as you say, he was in the RAF and he was an RAF pilot. He flew Spitfires and then he got transferred to flying bombers. He didn't actually start race riding until he was at an age where an awful lot of jockeys are already retiring. And before he was even in the RAF, he was a prodigy as a rider. He won the best boy rider at the Royal Richmond Horse Show, which was the biggest horse show in the country between the wars. And he won that when he was 9, and it was for anyone under 16.
Good Lord.
He won it again when he was 10, and they wouldn't let him enter anymore to give the others a chance. So, he was born to the saddle. His father had been an amateur jockey. His grandfather had been an amateur jockey. And Dad's wanted to become a professional. And end of 1946, beginning of 1947, he achieved that. And he rode for 10 years. He was champion jockey in 1953-54, which was the year I was born. And, of course, the defining moment in his life was in the 1956 Grand National, when he rode Devon Lock for the Queen Mother, was well in front with just 40 yards to go, and the horse inexplicably collapsed with its front legs out in front and its back legs out behind. I mean, I was 3 years old at the time, and it's a bit of a surprise to me that I ever made it to my fourth birthday, because according to my mother, I would scamper across the sitting room floor, throw my hands out in front and legs out the back and say, "I'm being Devon Locked, down I go bump," which was probably not the most tactful thing for a three-year-old. But in later life, he admitted that he probably owed more to Devon Locked's collapse than if it, the horse had won.
He does mention it in his autobiography, of course he does, and it was a tragedy for him. I mean, it ruined his chances of winning the Grand National. But how did it shape his life then otherwise?
Well, the following January, he'd had a terrible fall at Newbury and fractured his wrist and ruptured his spleen. And he was hoping to ride Devon Lock again in the 1957 Grand National because the horse had recovered. But then the horse pulled a tendon, what in racing parlance is known as breaking down, and the horse was retired from racing. So my father thought that now was the time to go. So he announced it live on television, Peter Dimmock on BBC television. And Peter said to him, well, what are you going to do now, Dick? Are you going to train? Are you going to become an official? Are you? And Dad said, well, I've half written my autobiography. I'll see what happens. You know, I'll finish that and see what develops. And John Junior, who was editor of the Sunday Express in London, obviously heard this, and he got in touch with my father and said, well, if you've half written your autobiography, you must be able to put a few words together. Would you write half a dozen articles for my newspaper? And that's how it all started, because those half dozen articles went on for 16 years full employment, never missed a deadline.
Derek, you've been nodding your head. Yeah. Now, you were far too young to actually commentate on the fall of Devon Lock, but do you remember at all when that happened? Do you remember?
Of course.
Yes. Oh, how old were you, if I dare ask?
I was 6 years old. No, 5 and a half at that time, so I'm a couple of years older than Felix. But never, ever forget it. It was just incredible. And, you know, Dick Francis, that day at Aintree, I've always loved, there's been something about the Grand National, it is the greatest steeplechase, greatest race in the world. And I was lucky enough to, in 1973, I became the youngest commentator on the Grand National at the age of 22 when Red Rum caught Crisp in the best race ever. But I'll never forget watching the black and white. Just imagine, you know, if you went to a Hollywood producer and said, hey, I got this story about this horse who's going to win the greatest race in the world, owned by the Queen, and then it collapses 40 yards, and the producer would say, don't be stupid, never happened. It did. It actually did. And how must the Queen Mother, how would she have felt watching a horse, cheering the horse, and the whole country cheering the horse home, a royal winner, and then it was next to the water jump, which they only jump once, and there was a bit of shade, they said. And you're saying no. And somebody said perhaps the horse jumped the shade.
No, people don't really know, do they?
Well, Dad is convinced. I mean, he didn't know.
Dad, as in Dick.
As in Dick, yes, yes. My father, Dick. He didn't know at the time. But if you look at the film very carefully, and my father, of course, did. I mean, I watched it. I must have watched that 1,000 times. I just wish he'd win it once, you know. But the horse pricks his ears just before he comes towards the water jump. And it was because it was the royal horse. It was not that long after the war. It was certainly not that long after Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, had been widowed. She was the most popular person in the world, almost certainly in our country. And as Derek says, everyone was cheering. And my father says that when the horse pricks his ears, that wall of noise hit the horse, and just for a fraction of a second, it frightened the horse, and that was enough, and down he went. My father had to get off the horse. I mean, the horse had pulled all the muscles in its legs, I mean, and he was walking up towards the grandstand, and he could see this mass of people running towards him, you know, for a post-mortem of what the hell had happened. And an ambulance came up the track, and the driver wound down his window, and he said, hop in the back, mate. And my father said he'd never been so pleased in his life to get in an ambulance. And the ambulance took him round to the to the weighing room. And then Peter Caslett, who was the horse's trainer, came in and said to my father, well, we better go and see the royal party. And I mean, Dad thought he was going to get sent to the Tower. and he went up, and there was the Queen and the Queen Mother, just and my father and Peter Caslett, just the four of them. And the Queen Mother said, well, what happened, Dick? And he said, well, I really don't know. He said the horse didn't jump. It didn't bunch to jump. It wasn't as if he jumped a shadow. There wasn't any sunshine on that day. And the Queen Mother looked at him and said, well, Dick, that's racing. And my goodness, it was. And And it actually cemented a lifelong friendship between the Queen Mother and my father.
It was interesting.
Derek, yeah.
If that happened now, that'd be front page news around the world.
We're still talking about it, aren't we?
Yeah, so, agreed.
I mean, the race is 4.5 miles, and he was literally 40 yards away from winning.
I think we can all sort of feel that pain now. I mean, you're relating it
but
so
it, but
well.
But in a sense, we've all benefited from it, tragically. Because
of the books.
Because he then went on to write these wonderful books.
It was a disaster at the time, obviously. Yeah. And
what a life lesson, though, too, really.
He had incredible,
for all of you. Hazel.
I don't know, sort of joie de vivre almost. And I did watch an interview with I think he was a Australian commentator interviewing your dad, and he said, you know, aren't you absolutely terrified before you go out onto the course? And he said, no, absolutely not. You know, you're always thinking of winning.
Well, the jockeys are, and I get into trouble for saying this, but I always think they're a bit like habitual criminals. And
that's why he became a thriller writer.
Only insofar that the a jump jockey, when he goes out to race in whatever race, always believes he's going to get round. If he had any sense about him, he'd realise that past experience was likely to be a predictor of future occurrence. And I mean, my father broke so many bones in his body. He broke his collarbone 6 times on each side for a start. Yeah. And as he said, he never counted ribs. But and a habitual criminal never learns from the fact that they get caught. And every time they go out to do a job, they think they won't get caught. Well, a jump jockey believes that they're going to get round. And they're not going to hit the ground at 30 miles an hour and be eating grass.
By the
Derek.
Way, the phone has been going crazy since you mentioned jump jockeys are habitual criminals. I've had 40 calls already. Will you give Felix a kick on the back?
I've got to stop you now. There's so many stories to tell. And I know, and Derek is bursting at the seams as well. I need to ask you, though. Can you remember meeting Dick Francis the first time?
It's a very good question. And yes, I saw him at the race course. He had a trilby on, and that was Dick Francis. Wow. To this day, yes.
So did you read all the Dick Francis novels? And did you also have this feeling, you know, this is a great jockey? And what makes a great jockey?
Oh, he was a great horseman. I mean, obviously a great jockey, but he was also a great horseman. And that is the difference. There are jockeys and there are jockeys and horsemen. It would be one of the top five of all time. He was that good. But to then start writing, you know, he left school at 15, your dad, didn't he?
Yes.
You know, with no qualifications at all. And he ended up becoming one of the world's best-selling authors. You are? Come on, don't be stupid. But it happened.
P.D. James, Phyllis James, she left school at 15 too, so... Yeah, he wasn't alone in that respect.
Incredible, and I respect that.
But
you know,
he was so determined, wasn't he? I mean, in his The Sport of Queens, which is his
autobiography.
Well, when he goes into the RAF and he's absolutely determined he wants to fly, and they make him a fitter, don't they? And
he's devastated by that.
He's absolutely determined to fly, and with a huge amount of persistence, he gets there, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. I mean, he was very determined in everything he did, and also had an immeasurable amount of energy always.
Let's try and sort of get to the crux of, you know, what made him a great writer, because you've been talking about him as a great horseman, a great jockey, and obviously a wonderful man as well. I mean, reading the Sport of Queens, his autobiography, which he published pretty much just after the fall, the fall, as we're calling it.
The collapse.
The collapse and the end of his chances winning the Grand National. I mean, this comes over as a really quietly wise, modest, warm man. Is that a good description of him?
Completely and utterly. He was very modest. He was extremely kind to everybody. A great family man. I mean, I grew up in what I consider to be the greatest fiction factory of the 20th century. The books had Dick Francis on the cover, but the books were a joint enterprise between my father and my mother.
You've been very open about this all along. It's not as if you've hidden the fact that these have been collaborations.
It was it was...
You called it the family business, I think.
It was definitely the family business. That's what my mother called it. In fact, every member of the family was included in the books at some point. One of the books has got a physics teacher in it. That was me. But stories used to pour out of my father like water over a waterfall. I mean, when I was at boarding school, he would send me a letter. He would send me and my brother letters every week. And one week, one of us would get the top copy, and the other one would get the carbon copy. And he never forgot whose turn it was. And they always had "Dear Felix" written in hand at the top and "Love, Pop" at the bottom. Ooh. And they would start off by saying, you know, what he'd been doing, and they would turn into stories. I mean, he had an absolute passion for storytelling. And my mother had a passion for what I call the rhythm of a sentence. And my mother would polish his prose. My father was always known by my mother as Richard, not least because her sister also married someone called Dick. And he was Dick and my father was Richard. And everyone called him Richard. And to me, Dick Francis was always Richard Francis and Mary Francis, conjoined at the pencil, as it were. And I mean, my father often said, even during my mother's lifetime, that he would have loved to have her name on the cover as well, but she wouldn't hear of it. She said, "Dick Francis is the two of us, and Dick Francis is the brand." And indeed now, my books have Felix Francis, but they also have a Dick Francis novel on, because to me, Dick Francis is a brand, and it's my choice to have that on the cover, not the publisher's. And it is because I feel that he is still as much a part of my books now as I feel part of all the previous ones.
Incredible.
Derek, tell me.
The thing that I find incredible is that Dick Francis was a jockey, you know, and jockeys are jockeys, but the racing world, because these books are all about skullduggery, is that the right word?
Very much so.
Very much so. And, you know, racing, certainly in those days, perhaps nowadays, not so much now, because obviously there are cameras watching every race, blah, 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 blah.
They do make it very much more difficult these days. I mean, dope testing and cameras and
exactly
DNA has made life much more difficult for a crime writer.
Racing is a sport which brings royalty together with the man who hasn't got a job.
The great leveller.
Oh, it's incredible.
You know, the national psyche.
Oh, it's an incredible sport.
But there's something I'm really proud of about my father, and I'm very proud of it about my own writing, and that is that, yes, they're about skullduggery, but we never write racing down.
Okay.
Racing is very much something of importance. But equally, the books are not about horses. They're about people. Racing is simply the canvas against which I write the story, and my father did it for me. And it's a wonderful canvas because, as Derek says, you know, the royalty and the man in the street go racing. It's highly competitive. There's lots of money around, a lot of it in cash. Everyone is trying to get an edge on everyone else. Everyone is trying to win. And some people will go to lengths where they're illegally trying to get an edge. I mean, most of that occurs in my books and my father's books. I like to think that racing is a lot straighter than exists inside the Francis,
is
inside
it?
The covers.
Well, is it? Of course it is.
I think it is. I think it is. I think it is now. I'm not so sure it was when my father started writing. But racing is becoming a much more of a young person's activity. And if you go to Cheltenham, there's lots of people in their 20s and 30s, whereas I think if you go back 50 years, they were all 10 or 15 years older.
So?
I don't think the young people would come into racing if they didn't consider it was straight.
But do you think that young people are as interested in reading your father's books? I read Dead Cert, which was the one that we've all mentioned, Derek as well, which was the first book. And it just feels so quaint and, you know, it's early days, obviously,
of course.
There wasn't much technology. And as you say, there was lots of cash. And, you know, women were women, and there were definitely no female jockeys at that time. And whereas when you're writing, of course, you know, your latest book, there is a female
dark
jockey.
Dark Horses, dark about horse. A female jockey, yes.
So much has changed. And I just wonder whether it's difficult for young people to tune into what your father was writing about in those days.
I think that partly the young people don't read as much today as they used to, because there's too many other things that are there at a touch of a screen and so on. But I do have a number of young people who have read the books, and they love them. I mean, they do love them. And the characters always tend to be younger. I mean, in Dark Horse,
that's your latest novel,
Imogen Duffy, the Irish jockey, she's 22. Hmm. And I'm trying to write as a 22-year-old in the first-person narrative. And a woman. I have used a woman before in one book, but mostly they're men. I think that the trick is getting people to open the book in the first place. Mm. I mean, always write a good first line. You know, people.
Well, this year, 2026, is the year of reading. It's a big campaign in this country for get people reading, people reading.
Can I just say that this book, you know, and I've read all of them. I remember when he was the teacher, and then he left to become a full-time writer. So I've known him a long time, and his dad and family. I read it in 2 days. What was it, about 250 pages?
And 400.
400. So I couldn't stop reading it. It is one. And I know you say you couldn't put it down and all that. We've heard that before, but I couldn't put it down. I had a book, I didn't write it, but somebody wrote it for me, called Too Busy to Die.
Can I just roll back on that? Because this is really important to bring in you as a writer, I think, actually. I mean, Derek, you've written your own autobiography with some help, as you say, Too Busy to Die. But now, that's one hell of a title as well. But to read from the blurb of the book, you understand not only horses, but writers as well. And, you know, that combination which Dick Francis had so brilliantly, you know, what is so attractive to writers about horse racing and vice versa? I mean, what is that combination?
It's just a wonderful combination. And working in it, having worked in racing all my life, I feel as if I know the characters. I know who that was based on, who that was based. I think I know. I've narrowed it down to one or two people. My book, Too Busy to Die, and the reason I mentioned that is because people said, why should I read your book, Thomas? I said, because you're guaranteed to fall asleep within 5 pages. So it's a real good way of going to sleep at night and you'll be snoring your head off.
I doubt that. I really doubt that. Though you've got so many wonderful anecdotes and catchphrases in your book. And I just want to talk about anecdotes and catchphrases. I mean, what are your catchphrases?
Well, you know, when it's a close finish and it is a photo, you know, I always say, it's a photo, that's one for the judge. And, it's true because, you know, you think you can work it out which nose is in front. But if you do call it wrong, that doesn't go down very well. So I always call it a photo. If it is a photo, it's a photo finish. And the judge then go, photo finish, and people are waiting, and here's the result of the photo finish, first number, and there's a great big cheer, or whatever, if you back that one. So I always tried to make racing exciting. That's a natural thing, isn't it?
It is exciting, yes. It's a lot more exciting than sitting in a quiet room on your own writing. I mean, as you said, I was a physics teacher. Becoming an author was really a bit of a mistake. I was also managing my father's affairs, you know, which meant everything from doing the investments to changing the light bulbs. And
is that because you wanted to or because you had to? You had to do that for your parents?
Well,
it was a big switch for you.
When I was teaching, my parents had moved to America and my mother's health wasn't good. Mm. My mother had polio when she was 26 and it left her breathing difficulties. And, you know, in the winter here, she would be really ill. She'd take to her bed in October and she wouldn't appear until April. And one year they went and spent time in Penang. Dad was writing the Lester biography.
He wrote a biography of Lester Piggott.
Yes, and Lester said, well, if you want to come and talk to me, I spend a month in Penang after the end of the flat racing season here. And if you want to talk to me, you're going to have to come there. And so my parents went out there and my mother wasn't ill at all the whole of that winter. And they said that they're going to try and find somewhere warm to spend the winters. And they went to Florida. And in the end, they moved to Florida and sold up here. And my father now had tax pay in the United States. And I was out there on holiday with my wife and children. And my mother said, your father's having difficulty getting things ready for the accountant. Would you help him? And so I went in and I said, come on, Dad, I'll help you. It can't be that difficult. Famous last words. It was incredibly difficult. And I spent most of the holiday working for him. And thereafter, during half terms and school holidays, I'd fly out to Florida and help him prepare because he had to do quarterly tax returns. Then I was head of science at Bloxham School. They brought in the national curriculum, GCSEs, assessments. And I said to my father, I can't do this anymore. What you need is a manager. And he said, would I be prepared to give up my day job? And I said, well, you don't pay me for what I do for you. And he said, I'll pay you twice what you're getting now. So cool. It wasn't so it wasn't that difficult a decision. On the other hand, my father was by this time he was 70 years old, and I was giving up a career. So I said the condition was there'd be at least 5 more books. Well, in fact, there were 10, so that was great. My father and mother decided to retire. Actually, they wanted to retire in 1999.
Do you mean, in other words, give up writing books?
Give up writing books.
Give up researching books in your mother's case, because she was a brilliant researcher.
They went to Ascot to see the Queen Mother and to give her a copy of the latest book. This was at the meeting at the end of July. And my father had often said to the Queen Mother, can I dedicate a book to you, ma'am? And she would wave her long finger at him and say, only when I'm 100. And so in 1999, my father presented her with this book. I think it was £10 penalty, and was about to say, this is the last one because we are retiring. And she said, I'm so looking forward to my book next year. And I remember driving my parents home that day, and they were going, oh, God, we've got to do it again. We've got to do it again. And so they did it again, and the book was shattered. And by God, it was well named.
The title of the book was shattered.
My God, it was well named, because by this time they had moved down to the Caribbean, and I went out to collect the manuscript, and I got there with a week to go before the deadline, and it was only 2/3 written. Literally sat down at the dining room table and I wrote the last third.
Did you type it or is it handwritten?
I typed it.
Yeah.
That used to handwrite it and then type it, but I typed it straight onto computer. And the book went in, and no one knew, no one was told, no one noticed the difference. And then they announced their retirement in September of the year 2000, beginning of September when the book was published. And it definitely was one book too far, because my mother died of a heart attack at the end of that month. Wow. So her long and happy retirement.
The year 2000.
The year 2000. And my father was now 80, and he reiterated the fact that that was it. And everyone thought that there wouldn't be any more Dick Francis books. However, in the beginning of 2005, my father's literary agent asked me for lunch, and I went and had lunch with him, and he said, Felix, we have a problem. And I said, what's that? He said, all your father's books are going out of print. It's not because they're not good enough. It's because there are so many books published in this country that the bookshops haven't got room for the new ones, let alone keep the old ones. And there hasn't been a new Dick Francis for 5 years. And Andrew said, what we need is a new hardback. And I looked at him and I said, are you crazy? You know, my mother and father did them together. My mother's been dead 5 years. My father is 85 and his memory is not what it was, you know. I mean, and you need a good memory in order to write a book. Because you need to remember what you've written. And the agent said, no, what I'm actually asking is your permission to ask an existing established crime writer to write a Dick Francis novel by so-and-so, just to stimulate the backlist. Well, I'd obviously had a few glasses of red wine by this stage, and I said to him, well, before you ask anyone else, I would like to have a go. And to his eternal credit, he didn't roll his eyes or laugh. I'd written bits of Dick Francis books for years. I designed the bomb that blew up an aeroplane in Rat Race when I was a 17-year-old physics student.
Good stuff.
I had written a lot of the meteorology in Second Wind because I studied meteorology at university. And I'd done the last third of Shattered. So Andrew said, well, I'll give you 2 months to write 2 chapters and then we'll see. What he meant was he'll then get the permission he wants. And I went home and I wrote those 2 chapters. They were long. They ended up being 4 chapters in the book. And we had another lunch and Andrew read the chapters and he said, well, there's 2 things you've got to do. One, you better get on and finish it. And secondly, you better go and talk to your father. The talking to my father was more difficult than finishing it. Anyway, I went to see my father and I said, we need a new hardback. No, he said. I said, it could be about race fixing, because race fixing was very much in the news, because champion jockey Kieran Fallon was about to go on trial at the Old Bailey. for race fixing, even though he was acquitted. And then, and my father said no. I said it could be a Sid Halley book.
Sid Halley, I've got to interject here because not everybody will know that, but Sid Halley is one of probably the only recurring character in the Dick Francis novels, and he's because he doesn't actually have recurring characters very often.
There are five of them, aren't there?
There are actually seven now.
Seven Sid Halleys.
But Sid is lucky because he doesn't age as much as the rest of us, because he started in 1965 and he's only about 20 years older now than he was then. But anyway, I said it'd be a Sid Halley book, and I'd already written the start of the book using the Sid Halley character, because it felt to me that it was easier to use an existing character. And my father said no. And I said, well, I've got a title. All the Francis book titles are meant to be two double meanings. And the title was Under Orders, which it means under starter's orders, but also good for race fixing. And he read my chapters. He got very excited by it. I got on and finished it. The book came out in 2006. It came out with Dick Francis on the cover. The only clue in the book to the fact that I wrote it, it says on the thanks page, and thanks to my son Felix for everything. Mm-hmm. And I wrote the book. And of course it sold because it had Dick Francis on the cover. It had to have that name on the cover as far as I was concerned if it was going to stimulate the backlist. I was terrified that the reviewers would all say in the Sunday papers Dick has lost it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they didn't. They all said, the master is back. And then the publisher said, right, well, I want another one. So I got writing Dead Heat, and it came out with Dick Francis in huge letters on the front and underneath in the smallest font they could find, and Felix Francis. Mm. And my name's got bigger over the years. And as you said at the beginning, they're all still in print, so I must be doing something right.
Well, you are definitely doing something right. I mean, you've written 19 novels in total, and some together with your father. It is an absolutely, you know, incredible achievement. But also, this is a publishing phenomenon as well. It's made a huge dent in publishing. I mean, in a good, positive dent in publishing. And to have all those books still in print.
I wanted to ask you, Hazel. Felix, how much you feel sort of, in a way, well, not constrained exactly, but I know your dad said, you know, that he never had bad language and so on because, you know, the Queen Mother might not like it. You know, how much you feel you have to sort of, in a way, stick to some extent.
Because, you know what, it's so interesting. Stuff. I'm glad you asked that, because this idea of it being a family business and the books being co-written to a certain degree, does that mean that a book is better if it's co-written? I mean, how do you explain this collaboration, you know, all these different aspects we've been discussing? Do they make better books?
I don't know the answer to that. I grew up with them. I would read them as they were being written a lot during the 1980s and 90s in particular. I think that discussion between my parents helped the book. I mean, I can remember as a child, the discussion over the breakfast table would not be on who's doing the school run today, but would be, you know, could Sid Halley survive the night with a .38 slug in his guts with his blood dripping through a crack in the linoleum floor?
Wow.
There was a lot of discussion. I discuss my plots with my wife and I get her feedback from it. And Debbie is very good. Just before the book goes in, she reads the whole book out loud. We have print out two copies. And we spend 3 days and she reads the whole book from start to finish out loud while I follow and I make notes and things. And I reckon if I can get it past her, I can get it past my editor without any problem.
What Hazel was asking too, whether you ever feel constrained by the fact that, you know, Dick Francis, your father, was this great, you know, horseman, but also racing legend and so on. Are there any sort of formulae or structures even?
Or that he actually had any particular rules, you know, by which
was he strict about that?
Certainly, as you said, you know, I remember the Queen Mother said to him once, Dick, you're getting a bit bloodthirsty. And so he toned things down a bit. And then certainly, I mean, it's funny because there is some bad language, but very little bad language. You know, I'm only allowed two or three expletives. I mean, in one book, I had them all on the first page, mind. That was the Crossfire, where it was all in the army at the beginning. But racing itself is full of bad language. I mean, my father was nicknamed the Vicar when he was a jockey in the jockey change room because he didn't use bad language. Mm. So as much as some incredible. Of the others. Anyway, so there were constraints on that part. And yes, when I finish the book, I do a word count, you know, how many bloodies appear, and I take out some of them. How many F words appear, and I take out almost all of them. And my father always said that in order for swearing to be effective, it had to be rare, and then it became as a shock.
Yes.
But it's also also extraordinary that, you know, there's a lot of violence in the books. I mean,
but not gratuitous violence.
No, well, I mean,
do you know, I don't think there is.
And it wouldn't be a Dick Francis novel if the main character didn't get beaten up.
Exactly.
At least
that's
once
I mean.
In a car, you know, in a race course car park. Yeah.
Can I ask you? I mean, we've been talking about the fact that this is a different era in many ways, but there is something which, of course, you know, we no longer have the Queen or the Queen Mother, and you have referred several times, Felix, to the Queen Mother being a great fan. Did your father literally go along with each book every single year, because he produced pretty much a book a year, and hand it over to the Queen Mother?
He did. We always used to get an invitation to the Royal Box on at the end of July for the King George VI and Queen Elizabeth Diamond Stakes, and the publishers knew that a copy of the book had to be ready at that point. I remember going with him often there, and I remember on one occasion the Queen Elizabeth II standing at the top of the stairs as we were climbing up with her hands on her hips like this, and saying, "And where is my copy?" So thereafter, she always had a copy. And indeed, when I started writing, I would deliver copies of the book to Buckingham Palace on publication.
Derek, did you know them both personally too?
Yeah. She came over to me once, the Queen, and she said, "I know you." I said, "I know you as well." I think this is, it's a sport of kings, or the sport of queens, as Dad's first book was. That's the sport of kings. And remember, America's got its Great Breeders' Cup, the France has got the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe, Melbourne Cup in Australia, all those, but nothing can compete with the British racing, and it's thanks to the royalty getting involved, and we must keep them involved, and they love it.
This idea of, you know, you can be a good horseman, obviously to be a good horseman, to be a good jockey, to be a good writer, all those things don't come naturally to everybody, to all of us. And I must say, Derek, to come back to you, I mean, to be a good racing commentator is really difficult. And it is one thing that I know that I would never have been able to do. So I'm actually going to ask you at this moment to just tell me, how do you become a good racing presenter?
Well, there's only 19 of us in the country. I think it's probably the most exclusive club going, but we never think that. We just go to the races. And when I was 5 years old, I used to get my pens out and I would colour the horses and turn the sound down on BBC television and do the commentary. And my dad took me to the races at Stockton when I was 5 years old, and we backed all five winners. That's how many races there were in those days. And I can still remember the horses, tell you the horses' names, etc. And we won £4.17/6. You know, which was in those days was a lot of money. And I thought, wow, this is good. And to this day, I remember when I was coming out of a betting shop, I bumped into the headmaster one day when I should have been at school. And I thought, oh no, this is it, I'm finished. I was counting my money, counting the pound notes. And he turned around and said, "Thompson, I don't mind you going into betting shops as long as you tell me what's going to win. Now get back to school." And he could have finished me. You know, and I was obviously too young, but he didn't. And it's things like that. I learned more about life. Then when I left school, I went to work in a racing stable. And you learn, you watch, and you're amazed, you know.
But how do you actually, you know, it's such a gift of eloquence.
It was my father started the commentary at the Point to Point, and I used to help him. And at the age of 15, halfway round a race, he turned the microphone off, handed it to me and said, "I can't see them anymore. My eyes have gone. Take over." So I took over the mic, switched it on. Said, "They go towards the next on the far side and it's still brilliant girl in the lead, blah, blah, blah." And that's how it started.
I wrote Felix. A book called Bloodline where my main character was a race caller and worked for Channel 4 Racing, as it was in those days. And I spent a lot of time with one of Derek's great mates and colleagues, Mike Catamol. And I mean, the first line of the book is, they're off. And he's commentating on a race at Lingfield Park. I've shadowed Mike for, you know, about a week. And I tell you what, writing books is easier than what they do. I said to him, did you learn all the colours the night before? He said, oh, no. I go and look at them in the parade ring, and I have the colours there, but I learn them just before the race. And what they do, I mean, I've tried to do it. I tried to do what Derek did, which was turn the sound down and commentate myself. Hopeless.
I'm going to stop you there because I want to ask, I mean, Derek, are you going to indulge us in a little thing we'd like to do with you, if you'd be so kind? Now, we want to bring it back to asking everybody what their favourite Dick Francis or Felix Francis novels are. We'd be very open about that. Mm-hmm. And we have quite a few to choose from. And we were wondering, because we've got a printout here of all the books, and we were wondering whether you would give us a mock racing commentary. You'd actually read out all the titles and in your inimitable way, thereby giving me some tips on how to speak very fast with many words in one sentence as possible. And we thought we'd love to hear that. And then we'll go around the table and ask everybody at the very end of our podcast what they think is their favourite book.
Okay, they're being called in. They're being called in for the Dick Francis Grand National. The white flag is up. And there's stacks of runners in this, 19 runners in this, they've been called, and they're off, to a good start, and Nerve got a good start, Dead Cert is right there, Forfeit was a little bit sluggish, Bone Crack, I like he's moving well, Sleigh Ride is going like a sleigh ride at the moment, and High Stakes, there's a lot of money there for that, that's coming on the, and coming towards Beaches for the first time. Now, here they come, it's the Big Fence, Flying Finish, soars over the, Bloodsport is down, and he's brought down Forfeit, oh goodness me, the favourite is out of the race. Smokescreen is also staying on. Sleigh Ride is right there as well. I can see High Stakes and Doctor in the Frame is also beginning to get into the frame at the moment. Risk and Trial Run. Whip Hand. The whip's up on that. The jockey is going for it. Reflex. Twice Shy is still way behind at the moment. So they're coming at the home straight. There's only two fences left to jump. And this is going to be interesting. And it could be a very close finish. There are stacks of contenders. Pulse is still in the lead. A Crisis is beginning to get guilty or not guilty. I wonder if that could trouble the judge. It's going to be an interesting one. They're coming towards the line. There's only 50 yards to go. And Syndicate is going clear. Oh, he's fallen. Oh, my goodness me. He's collapsed. Oh, drama here. And would you believe it? In the Dick Francis Grand National, the horse has Syndicate. He's gone down. And it's hands down. Who's come through to win it? Oh, that is incredible. What a finish.
Oh, brilliant. Ladies and gentlemen, the great Derek Thompson there. Oh,
my well God. Done. That's wow. Good.
Did you back the winner?
Well, that's all you need to know.
20-1.
Well, you take a little break, Derek. I'm going to ask actually Felix first, which is your dad's favourite book? Which is your favourite book of your dad's?
Right. Well, I loved Bone Crack because it was the story of two fathers and two sons, and how the relationship between the sons affected the relationship between the sons and their fathers, and between the two fathers. It's not a whodunit. You know whodunit right at the beginning. So that was probably my favourite. But Whip Hand, which was Sid Halley's second outing, is probably the one that had the greatest critical success. It won the Crime Writers Association Gold Dagger as the best mystery novel of the year in the United Kingdom. It also won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for best mystery novel in the United States. And only two books have ever won both. And the other one was The Spy Who Came in from the Cold by John le Carré. So I think that Whip Hand is in very good company there. And when someone asks, which book should I read first? I always say, well, start at the top, read Whip Hand.
Derek, have you recovered?
Just, my brother. It was a close finish there. A dramatic one.
Which did you like best? You're obviously allowed to choose as many as you like.
People often ask me, what's your favourite race course? And the answer to that is the next one. Because it doesn't matter whether a 5-1 winner at Royal Ascot is the same as a 5-1 winner at Sedgefield doesn't matter, it's the same price. And a winner is a winner. So if you say, what's your favourite Dick Francis or Felix Francis book, I would say, the next one.
Excellent, we'll take that. Now, Gail, obviously I have to come to you. You've been listening rapt to all of that, and you've read nearly all of them.
I've read nearly all of them, and recently I've reread about 10 of them. And the one I particularly liked of the recent batch is High Stakes, which involves swapping horses, and it's just very, very clever and very inventive.
Swapping horses,
so
in a race.
The character, actually, this is one of the many reasons I enjoyed Dick Francis. The particular hero in this book is a toy maker or a toy inventor, and creates these mechanical toys, makes a lot of money, and therefore decides to become an owner of racehorses. And he gets diddled by his trainer and gets his revenge. And I won't say more than that because it'll give the story away.
Yeah. So it's one of my favourites too.
Yeah.
Hazel, now you and I are in the same boat here.
We hadn't
actually read many Dick Francis, and I know, but we're being open about it. But we have read quite a few in the last few weeks. And I've also read, as I can see here on the table, the Sport of Queens, the autobiography, which is really wonderful.
Yes. I did love that, actually.
Yes, I did too.
I think it's great.
And Felix Francis, of course. I love Dark Horse. Well, what else, Hazel?
Well, I tremendously did enjoy Dark Horse. I thought it was a real page-turner, you know, and the fantastic twist at the end. And I very much enjoyed Dead Cert.
That was the first one. Yeah. I read that one as well.
I really liked that. I loved the first experience. I love the evil taxi drivers, you know, and the sort of just the sort of sense of, you know, sort of foreboding on the race course. And I liked the hero. You know, he's a sympathetic kind of hero, isn't he?
I just really want to just mention the couple that had been written at the end of his life when you were, Felix, writing with him. And the one that really struck me, Crossfire, was 2010. And when I read that this time, knowing that he died in 2010, and then the next one, of course, the Gamble, 2011, there was a poignancy to that. And well, I felt very sad about both of those books.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. Unfortunately, my father didn't even read any of Crossfire. He died when it was half written. He died on Valentine's Day. As I always say, you know, always the romantic, went to rejoin my mother on Valentine's Day in 2010. The book was only two-thirds written at that time, and he hadn't even read a page of it. And Crossfire, my main character is an army officer, and it starts in Afghanistan. My character loses his leg, he loses his foot in an IED explosion in Afghanistan. So the book is very much about him coming to terms with his injury and the fact that it means that his army career is over. And he's got nowhere to go, so he goes back to live with his mother and stepfather, and his mother's a trainer, and he discovers all sorts of things going on, and so he becomes the investigator. I enjoyed writing the book hugely. There was quite a few bodies appear at various stages during the book, and my character was the only trained killer, and he was the one who didn't kill anybody in the book. So I enjoyed playing around with that.
We have to somehow end this podcast. We could literally go on for many, many more hours. It's been such a pleasure to have you both here, Derek Thompson and Felix Francis, and to learn about your father's life and his work. And also thank you very much for basically, I think I've picked up quite a few tips. First of all, on how to write a good thriller. Not all journalists can, but I'll try my best. I've always wanted to write a thriller, actually. So anyway.
Well, my best advice is to, apart from getting someone else to read it out to you, my other advice I will take from Winston Churchill. Never, never, never give up.
Wonderful. I can hear the creative writing students getting very excited about that. And Derek, also, thank you for that absolutely wonderful commentary and for teaching me a few things as well. I don't think I can speak as fast as you, though. Definitely can't use as many words in one sentence as you can. But
it's been an honour. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much to both of you. And thank you very much also to Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood. Lovely to have you both here. I think you and I and all of us, we didn't get much of a a word in today. We were so entranced and enthralled by listening to Derek and Felix.
It was lovely to be able to sit back and listen.
Yes, it's absolutely fascinating.
It was lovely to see you both again. Thank you again very much indeed. And I'll be back after this short promo. Slightly Foxed is a small independent publishing house in Hoxton, East London. It was founded in 2004 by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, as a labour of literary love. Slightly Foxed publishes a quarterly magazine which appeals to passionate readers everywhere who enjoy engaging with a wide range of excellent writing, past and present, fiction and non-fiction. Slightly Foxed champions the lost, lesser-known or forgotten literary gems and celebrates the offbeat and unusual. Its contributors are also an eclectic bunch. Some are well-known novelists, distinguished journalists or academics. Others come from very different walks of life. Slightly Foxed also regularly reissues out-of-print books that deserve new audiences. The quarterly magazine has a global readership and is always happy to welcome more readers. It's posted out four times a year to over 60 countries. You can take out an annual subscription at a very reasonable rate, and this also gives you free access to all the back issues and the whole digital archive. That's well over 1,200 articles. If you'd like to subscribe, do visit our website, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd prefer to talk to a human being in the office, then phone us in the London office. Contact details are on the website. Today, the Slightly Foxed family comprises magazines, books, newsletters, the annual Reader's Day, and our podcast. Do join us. Thank you to the whole team here at Slightly Foxed. That's it for this episode. And as you notice, no recommended reads this time. We have such an embarrassment of riches with all the Dick Francis novels, the Felix Francis novels to read. So we've got a long list of reads already. See you in 3 months' time with more compelling storytellers and riveting tales. You'll find all the books and authors we've discussed today in the programme show notes, which you can easily access on your podcast app or the Foxed website, foxquarterly.com. And that's where you can also subscribe to our quarterly print magazine. Print or podcast, all of us at Slightly Foxed are united in our love of books and of great authors, past and present, in reading the best contemporary literature and in rediscovering lost and forgotten literary gems. My name's Rosie Goldsmith, and thank you so much for joining me.